Good morning. Welcome back to Nachiyami. Today we're going to be focusing on the 18th parak of Melachim Aleph. And today we have an episode which is a very famous episode in Tanakh. It is Eliyahu at Har Carmel. This is going to be the great showdown. And just for your own knowledge, think about when this is actually read as a Haftorah. Just food for thought, which parsha is this the Haftorah to? Okay, let's jump straight in. So the first section of the parak tells us that Eliyahu is sent back from the area of Tzarfas, which is where he's with this widow, and he's sent back to bring back rain. But Eliyahu does not give this as a simple equation. He makes it quite complicated. Here's what happens. He's heading back, and while he's heading back in the meantime, there's this coalition which has been made between a person called Ovadiahu, who's a prophet, and Achav, who's the king. Achav has turned to Ovadiahu and says, We need to find water so that we can sustain the animals. So not all the animals will die. Remember, we're talking about 3 years of famine, according to Tanakh now. So Ovadiahu and Achav are busy searching for water. While we learn about this, we're told that Ovadiahu is a special person. That in the meantime, Izebel has killed the prophets of God. Meaning to say, she doesn't want to hear from the God of the Hebrews. She is interested in him, so she silences all the people. She massacres all the prophets. And Ovadiahu is the person who saves 100 of those prophets. He finds caves and he puts 50 into each cave, and he brings them water and food at a time where food and water is very scarce. So he's clearly a very courageous person. We'll see the limits to his courage in a moment. But nonetheless, this is what happens, and Achav is now recruiting him, and there's this unusual description, how they divide up, and Achav goes one way to look for water, and Ovadiahu goes the other way to look for water. Just stopping at this point, just to think of the curious image that we have over here. Since when is it the prophet and the king who are looking for water? He has many, many people he can send to look for water besides for himself and his prophet. So the Malbim comments over here that what is really being described metaphorically is Achav is going in his way and Ovadiahu is going in his way. They live in the same place, but they're going to very different spiritual destinations in the hereafter. This description is metaphoric more than necessarily just a physical description. But in the meantime, they are walking, they are looking around, and into Ovadiahu Eliyahu bumps. So Eliyahu is coming down from the north, and he bumps into Ovadiahu, and he says, "Go and tell Achav, your master, that Eliyahu is coming." It's interesting that he calls Ovadiahu's master Achav, and Ovadiahu is very scared. He says, "I'm already in a place of tremendous danger. I'm harboring prophets of Hashem. I'm sustaining them. If I now go to Achav and I tell him, oh, Eliyahu's coming, and then you don't appear, he'll murder me immediately." Meaning to say, there's too much on my head to do this. And Eliyahu says, "But Achav's looking for me everywhere. He's trying to look for me in every country, and he hasn't found me yet. Go tell him." Ovadiahu won't do it. Ovadiahu is clearly very, very scared about what he's doing. He is clearly a leader, but a limited leader in the sense that he is doing something tremendously amazing behind the scenes, but he's terrified about the ramifications. So Eliyahu says, okay, and he goes himself. Off he goes. He goes in to proclaim himself to Achav. And he says, I'm going to go to Achav. He goes to Achav. Achav says, Achav tells him, "You, Eliyahu, are the reason why there's no water. You are the Oicher Yisrael. You are stopping the water in Israel," which is strange because you'd think that Achav at this point in time would be beaten into submission. Apparently not. Apparently it's much easier to blame than to look inwards to solve problems. And that's what Achav is displaying. Eliyahu says very clearly to him, "I'm not the one stopping. I'm the rain. You are. I set up the framework. You're not listening to it." It's like the parent who says, tells the child, "If you don't do such and such, there's going to be a consequence." The child gets the consequence, and the child says, "How could you do that to me?" The parent says, "I didn't do it to you. You did it to yourself. The consequence was set up." That's what the conversation is. So Eliyahu then turns to Achav and he tells him, "We're gonna set up a deal. I want you to bring 450 of the prophets of Baal and Asherah and bring them and meet me on the ones who eat on the table of your wife Izebel. Bring them to Har Carmel." And so it is. They bring it on, and Eliyahu turns to the entire people and he makes this proclamation. He says, "Ad mosai atem poischim al shnei ha'sefim. Till when are you going to be passing over the two Se'ifim, these two places? If you serve God, serve God. If you don't serve God, then if you serve Baal, then serve Baal. But you can't be both." It's interesting, Rabbi Angel points out here, you see something interesting, that the people who were serving Baal at this time, the Israelites who were serving Baal, wasn't because they ideologically believed in Baal more than they believed in Hashem. They were serving Hashem as well. They brought korbanos to Hashem as well. The issue was they were hedging. Basically, they were saying, look, Baal is the god of plenty, Baal is the rain god. So let's do a little bit of both, you know. We'll hedge our bets. We'll diversify our plan. We'll serve God a little bit, Hashem, and we'll serve Baal a little bit. And Eliyahu says, sorry, monotheism doesn't work like that. You can't do that. There's only one. So Eliyahu says, enough of the two-sided business, and you now need to decide. So he says, we're going to take two cows, and you're going to choose one. You're going to go first, and whoever's korban is accepted will prove that their God is the one that is believed. And the jewel's taken on. The Nevi Baal come along, and they take this pyre, they shechta, they put it onto the altar, and they start incantations and silence. Nothing. No answers. So Eliyahu starts taunting them. He says, "Oh, you know, maybe your God might be sleeping. You know, if you shout louder, maybe he'll wake up." And they start shouting louder, and they start cutting themselves and mutilating themselves as they do in their religion, and nothing happens. And kol ve'en oneh ve'en koshev. No responses. Interesting to see where else that phrase appears in Tanakh. Food for thought. Eliyahu then turns on and he says, bring me some water. And remember, water is scarce at this point in time. It's three years of famine. He takes water, he drenches the korban, he digs a trench around the korban, he drenches that, and then he turns to Hashem. And he fixes the altar of Hashem, which had been broken there, the Mizbeach, and he turns to Hashem and he says, Hashem, for the sake of Aram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, you got to save them. Aneni Hashem, aneni, answer me. V'yedu ha'om hazeh ki ato Hashem Elohim. You are God. V'ato hasibosas libam acharonis. You're the one who turned their hearts backwards. Debating them for Hashem. What does that really mean? Is Hashem taking away their free will? Is Hashem preventing them from getting to the right place? Big discussion. The Radak brings out many, many opinions. And finally, what happens is the miracle happens. The fire comes down from heaven, consumes the korban, consumes the altar, consumes all the water in the trough, and it is a clear expression of God. Every falls on their face, prostrates themselves, and says, Hashem hu alokim, Hashem hu alokim, which is a phrase we say at the end of Yom Kippur, based on this pasuk. And at this point in time, Eliyahu goes down, and he goes and shechts, he kills the prophets of Baal, all 450 of them, and he says to Ahav, now when you want rain, just wait now. And he goes to the top of the mountain and he turns to his Nair and he prays to Hashem. And slowly there's this beautiful description of seven times as he emits, then he prays for this cloud which comes upon the east and starts turning into a huge rain cloud, and rain comes down. What a beautiful description of the end of this parak. And the parak concludes how Eliyahu runs in front of the chariot. He girds his loins and runs in front of the chariot of Ahav Adboach Yisrael until he comes to Israel, which is where Ahav lives. And Rashi points out over here is that this is actually a description of honor, that Eliyahu was running in front of Ahav. First of all, that's a pretty supernatural ability to be able to run in front of a chariot, but it's also a description of honor that he is giving to Ahav by doing this. So let's just one or two just points to take away as we conclude this, because it is a very long parak. There's a lot just inside the parak besides this. Number one is, where is Izebel? That's the interesting thing. I just, as a side note to this parak, where is Jezebel? It's interesting, she does not appear here. We're going to see her next parak. She's apparently at home. The Radak points out that not all the prophets came to this meeting point, because if you read the psukim carefully, the prophets who are oichle shulchana, the ones who are by her table, she didn't allow to come to Carmel. She herself did not appear. She wasn't willing to pick up the gauntlet. She wasn't willing for the trial. Isn't this interesting? She knew she would lose. She wasn't prepared to lose. This shows you something interesting. You see this today in many, many, many times. When there's oftentimes debates or documentaries shown about the oppressions in certain Muslim regimes in the world, and they're not allowed to be shown on campus because the Muslim clubs close them down because they're not willing to have the dialogue about the truth yet. They're not even willing to have a discussion, even on the university campus, or the debate. That it shows you that a person already knows they're in the defense. They know they're going to lose. This is where Izebel is at this point. That's what the Radak points out. Just something very important as a superstructure. Two ideas just to take home. One is you see a very interesting idea which actually relates to Pesach over here. The idea is when he says, another way to understand it is not passing over, but the idea of Poseach actually can mean the word hover. That why are you hovering over? Why are you giving credence to two entities when you can only give credence to one? If you reread that back into Pesach itself, it gives you a whole new understanding. What does it mean that Hashem was Pesach ala Pesach, or Pesach ala Batim? What does it mean? So the beautiful explanation is given is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was standing next to the houses, was hovering over the houses of the Israelites while the Mashchis was going through. Remember, there's a contradiction. Is Hashem there, or is the Mashchis? This is this destructive force. Well, Hashem was there protecting the houses of the Jews from this mashkes. That's what it means, Pesach, from this perek itself. Very fascinating insight. Last thing, and we'll end with this, which is a messianic idea. The Chida points out in Chumash Tanach that at the end of the perek, when it talks about how Eliyahu goes in front of the chariot of Achav, he points out that if you look at the word Vayeshanes, which is the description of how he runs in front of the chariot, is actually the gematria of Mashiach ben David. And this is ideologically saying that Eliyahu has been sent where? To Yisrael, which is sort of the Zeruah ben Ha'amim, Israel who's spread out among the nations, because there's going to come a time where Eliyahu, at the end of days, is going to bring all those spread out Jews back, and that's the point that Mashiach will come. But we'll see that before we get there, there's one more bump in the road, and that's tomorrow's parak. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.